Hi, I'm Femi Oke, and you're in the stream. When Russia invaded Ukraine 3 months ago, it had hoped to overtake the country in a blitz lasting only days or perhaps a few weeks. But what looked certain then doesn't now. Today, we'll take a look at the war in Ukraine 90 days on.
In 3 months after the full-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine, it turned out that the Russian army is a paper tiger. It pretends to be the second army in the world, but as we see right now, it's just an army, a group of people, of looters, criminals, rapists, who did hundreds and thousands of cases of war crimes, and some of these troops were already sentenced in Ukraine, and many got also life sentence.
Joining us with the latest news out of Ukraine, Al Jazeera correspondent Ased Beg. He is in Kramatorsk and has been reporting extensively from the eastern regions of Ukraine. Ased, you have had an experience today that I want you to share with our audience. What happened? Tell us more.
Yeah, we were just in a town called Bakhmut. Russian forces are a number of kilometers away from there. So we were just meeting some people. We went in, but as we left, and we just literally just got the news that it's been hit by missiles. Now, this is, these towns get hit. A lot of the towns, villages, and cities in the east have been getting hit by Russian artillery and missile strikes. But, Bakhmut is a place where you go and sometimes it feels like a ghost town. Other times you go and it's surprising to see a child in the park on a swing and you just stop for a second and you just have to take it in. Mm-hmm. You know, like I spent so much time in the east and I hardly saw children in the park. Mm-hmm. And now whenever I see a child in the park, I just stop. Yeah. And I stare for about a minute just to take it in, just to take it in. And then you can always hear the artillery fire and you'll see some granny carrying her shopping, completely desensitized to it. But people are aware that the Russians can hit at any time and at any place. And in fact, we've visited residential buildings that had missile strikes, massive craters in the ground. And I went to one building that a few days later, they were still trying to get to the bodies. There was just so much rubble. And the constant fire of artillery was just carrying on. And that's the case across this region.
Asad, I've been following your reporting in Donbass as the Russians are, as you told us on Al Jazeera, closing in on two fronts. At that time, just a few days ago, Tatiana, a florist, was still doing business. I just want to share with our audience that moment that you had with her and then pick up on that strange situation where Ukrainians are in war but also doing everyday things at the same time. Here's Tatiana.
Down the street, the florists are still open.
People need flowers. Just a few minutes before, a man bought flowers. Now I'm chatting with a girl who wants to buy some flowers. It's scary during strikes, but generally I'm not scared. Children left, but I'm here. I have my own home and don't want to leave it.
What's the mood like there?
It varies. You will speak to some people and they are terrified, but they say, what are we supposed to do? You speak to Tatiana and she says, well, I have a responsibility to stay open because people want to buy flowers. A man came in earlier to buy flowers for his wife. A girl just ordered some flowers. And it's just those little things that sometimes people do to just keep going. Now, I was in Kharkiv, the second largest city, throughout March and early April. And you would not find a florist open there. Most places were closed. One third of the population had left. And even here, where I am now, and same in Kharkiv, we had to turn the lights off, close the curtains, and I was just going around in my room, in my hotel room, with a red tactical light because you can't see it from a distance, just when I was just trying to move around. So that's the situation that people are in. There's a lack of water, there's no hot water in many places, and a lack of gas and electricity. But people are still continuing because they have to. They have no other choice.
Right. You went into a town known as Solidar, and you went in through the back way because there was a battle going on. So you still went in. One of the most important things that I learned from your report, and obviously we know at Al Jazeera, is that in the East, there is support for Russia. Not every Ukrainian is anti-Russian. This is the gentleman that you spoke to earlier, and then come off the back and tell us more about this Russian support. First, let's have a listen.
Why are you wearing a helmet? For what? Russia will be here soon. Victory. Donbass was always Russian.
Asad, that's important, yeah. Right? That's really important that we understand.
Yes, I think there are people that will support Russia, that see Donbass as always Russian. They see themselves as Russian. They feel more affiliated and closer to Russia. We went to one town, small town, and the soldiers stopped us before we went in and just said, listen, be careful, the majority of people here support Russia. So you can't ignore that. Some people will be more outspoken about their support. Others will be vague. So when you go to a site that's been shelled or hit, and they say, well, you know, this could have been Ukraine. The police force here are constantly arresting and detaining people that are helping Russia. So this is one thing about supporting them and feeling close to Russia and questioning the war. There's another that there are people here that will give locations of military sites. They'll go on Google Maps and they'll send that location, and the next thing you know, you'll get hit. In fact, we went to one site in Bakhmut that was hit, and my fixer heard some people say some anti-Ukrainian things, and he looked up and he saw them. Now, the police released a picture just a few days ago of them arresting a man that they said had been helping Russia, given their locations, and he recognized the man. He was the man that we had seen on that day. Uh-huh. So that support does exist. You can't ignore it. Right. There are people throughout this country, especially in the East, that feel that, you know, this region was a part of Russia and they want it to be a part of Russia.
All right. So, Asad, thank you. Stay with us for the rest of this show. But I want to bring in another key player in the war, and that is NATO, the Intergovernmental Military Alliance between 13 member states. Last week, Finland and Sweden formally applied for membership, giving up decades of neutrality.
Swedish and Finnish applications to NATO demonstrate that even those traditionally neutral countries of Northern Europe have understood that Russia is a direct military threat to them. Judging from the experience of Ukraine, they see that they need to have support from other European and North American countries in the event of Russian military aggression against their sovereignty and territorial integrity. And I think what needs to happen next is actually a broader alliance of those countries which want peace and security on international scale to be strengthened and maintained to isolate Russia, to isolate the aggressor state.
So what does this new shift in European allyship mean for the war? Joining us, Susie Dennison. She's director of the European Power Programme at the European Council on Foreign Relations. Hi there, Susie. The idea of Finland and Sweden joining NATO, who knew that would even be a conversation, a headline that we would have in modern times? Can you explain the historic nature of them asking to join NATO, please?
Yes, well, thank you very much for having me. Indeed, it is a historic reversal. It was a decision that Finland and Sweden took at the beginning, from the outset of NATO's existence after the Second World War, that they preferred to stay out of the alliance. That was partly, particularly in the case of Sweden, I'm talking to you today from Stockholm, in line with a long tradition of neutrality. But it was also partly because, largely because, it was their view that they didn't want to provoke Russia by joining this alliance. They preferred to leave some neutral space in between Russia and the NATO lines. And now what we're seeing is that decision has been reversed in light of the current threat that these countries are feeling. They're very close to the Russian borders, particularly in the case of Finland. They share a very long border with Russia. And the assessment now is that the risk is greater to be out than to provoke Russia by being in. I think there's this sense that Russia is already on the march. It's already in aggression mode. And so there is more to lose by staying out.
I'm just wondering, though, if Sweden and Finland are in NATO. Doesn't that make Russia feel even more surrounded by NATO than it did originally, which is the reason Russia gave for going into Ukraine?
I mean, there is no question that this underlines the extent to which, if Putin's aim was to prevent NATO expansion, then it has backfired. But as I said earlier, I don't think that's the reasoning for doing this from the point of view of Helsinki and Stockholm. I think this is a response to the fear that they're feeling, the threat that they're feeling. And it's also very much in line with public opinion, which has shifted dramatically in these countries. And so the governments, I think, are responding more to that domestic imperative than they are to the need to isolate Russia further.
Yeah, Assad.
I've just heard saying that Russia is on the march. Isn't part of Putin's logic is not only that NATO has been moving closer to its western borders, but also, like, you know, we've heard this narrative that everyone's under threat now. But isn't Putin's logic also like he never really saw Ukraine as a state? He saw them as little Russians. So that's partly why he attacked Ukraine. There's nothing really that supports anything to say that he will attack Sweden or Finland or any other state.
I mean, I think that what you're describing is indeed Putin's narrative around this. But for it's very hard to overstate the extent to which here in Europe, there's a sense that this is a war in Europe. Ukraine is part of the broader Europe for the people living within the EU. And so I think there's a sense that right up until the last moment, very few political leaders believed that Russia would invade Ukraine in the sort of the all-out extent to which they did. And so in a sense, all the cards have been thrown up in the air. So I think nobody feels safe anymore in terms of assuming that there are limits to how far Russia would go when Putin essentially is the strategy is not working out for him. He is looking for ways out of this conflict which don't simply demonstrate that he hasn't achieved the objectives that he set out for. So in that sense, there's this feeling that all options are on the table.
Except that it's not that easy. Sweden and Finland can't just say, hey, we want to be part of NATO. NATO has to agree. And in NATO is Turkey, and Turkey has objections, basically because Finland and Sweden acknowledge and nationalist groups in Turkey that Turkey believe and view as being terrorist groups. So earlier, 19th of May, the foreign minister for Turkey met up with the Secretary of State for the United States, and they had a conversation, because basically the conversation has to persuade Turkey to say yes to this expansion of NATO. Susie, will you have a look at this video? Tell me what you see in the body language between the foreign minister of Turkey and the secretary of state of the US. What's going on here? Let's have a look.
You know, Tony, Turkey has been supporting the open door policy of NATO even before this war. But with regards to this possible candidates or already candidate countries, you know, we have also legitimate security concerns that they have been supporting terrorist organizations.
Susie, go ahead.
Well, I'm not an expert on body language, but what I would say is that what Turkey is doing at the moment is negotiating. As you said, all current members of NATO have to agree to an enlargement of the alliance, and Turkey can see an opportunity to push back against a policy which it hasn't been pleased with in recent years with regards to Turkey's view that the Kurdish People's Party is a terrorist group, and it isn't comfortable with the fact that Finland and Sweden along with other EU member states, actually, have raised questions about the Turkish government's treatment of this group. And I think it's important to acknowledge that it's not only Finland and Sweden who have called this into question, but this this application to join NATO is therefore a sort of a negotiating opportunity for Turkey to push back against that. And my assessment from reading the Twitter accounts of the leaders of Sweden and Finland over the last few days, and also their decisions to enter into conversations with the Turkish government about this, is that they are in negotiating mode. It's important right. enough for them to be able to join the alliance, for this application to go smoothly, that they are willing to talk about this and come to some kind of agreement with the Turkish right. government.
Susie, thank you so much for giving us insight into where we are in terms of Finland and Sweden joining NATO. Of course, this is a story that we will be watching very closely over the next few weeks. Finally, as the war grinds on, the humanitarian conditions across Ukraine are continuing to deteriorate, especially in the south and east, where there are wide-scale disruptions to electricity, gas and water supplies, and virtually no access to medical care.
We know that the scars caused by this conflict will remain for years, both on a physical but also mental level. Our mental health professionals are currently speaking with civilian families who have lost their loved ones and they're still processing their grief. What they tell us is that the pain is tremendous. So many families have been suffering and they continue to suffer.
Joining us is Joe English. He's an emergency communications specialist at UNICEF and he's recently returned from Ukraine. Joe, thanks for being on the stream again for us. 3 months into this war, what are you seeing that's different that you didn't see 3 months earlier?
Yeah, you know, as the guest just mentioned, the scale of this is absolutely staggering. You know, I don't think there's a single child in Ukraine at the moment who has not been touched by this one way or another. Now, in the south and in the east, obviously, we're seeing vicious fighting, and we continue to see children killed, children injured, losing their parents, seeing their homes, their schools, their hospitals, the places where they're meant to feel safe, coming under attack and being bombed. But even for those who've not been directly touched by the conflict, you know, many of them continue to see the destruction around them. You know, those who have fled as refugees have been forced to say goodbye to their fathers, to their grandfathers, to uncles, older brothers. And so, you know, it's almost difficult to imagine the long-term impact that this will have on kids. You know, UNICEF works all around the world providing this kind of care and support for children affected by war. And one thing that we know is that it's not a quick fix. You know, it really does take dedicated care and support to children, but also to their parents who are on the front lines of providing that care, to ensure that once finally there is a peace agreement, children and families are able to start rebuilding their lives.
I'm going to show two little kids. One is on your Twitter feed and one is part of showing the international community what UNICEF is doing. So right here on my laptop, the hospital where she was born, the kindergarten where she played and the school where she studied have now been destroyed. That was really what Joe was talking about right there, is what part of her life still remains intact. So that's one little girl. And then I want to introduce you to Artem. He was just 9 years old and he lives in a basement. Take a look.
Я спочатку думав, що це все швидко закінчиться. Пройде десь, ну, дня 2-3. Но після того, як я просидів тут неділю, я вже подумав, що це буде довго длитися. Уже сидим десь 2,5 місяця вже тут. Взрослых. Тут моя мама с папой лежат, там мы втроем. Саша, Алина и я. Война повлияла для меня обидой. Ну, просто уже хочется домой тут. Не очень интересно сидеть. Есть одна надежда, то, что война побыстрее закончится. И все будет хорошо, все будет мирно. Мы сможем гулять со всеми друзьями, увидеться в школе.
Joe, I don't know how you do your job and not want to just hug all the kids. I mean, bless his heart. They're living in metro stations, they're living in shelters. But there's more to this story. It's not just where they're having to live, where they're having to play, because UNICEF brings school to them, brings mental health support to them. Tell us more about that.
We are, you know, we do everything we can to reach children no matter where they are, and where we have this safe, unfettered access, we are getting in and providing, you know, toys and education supplies to kids who spent weeks, if not months, underground. Artem just then is an example of that. And he was there wearing his Oxford University sweater. And I grew up in Oxford, and it's hard not to imagine how, as a kid, to experience these kind of things. We know that no child should have to go through this, should have to experience this. And as Ased said earlier, you know, it's the kids' faces that you remember when you're there, when you speak to families. Yeah. You know, this is what sticks with you, their stories, when you're hearing the unbelievable things that they've been through.
Yeah, I actually recall 6-year-old Kira in Kharkiv. She hadn't been out for 2 weeks. She wanted to be a breakdancer. She was living in a basement in one of the worst hit areas in Kharkiv, South Africa. And as we were speaking to her, she recited a poem about the love that she has for her mother. And as soon as we stepped outside, all we could hear was the shelling and the rocket fire. Mm-hmm. And you say that, you know, you try and get to these places. But how do you address the issue of many of these children in places that are just really dangerous? Like, say, Bakhmut or Salada or, Severodonetsk, which is just, you know, under constant fire.
Yeah, it's incredibly difficult, you know, and UNICEF is part of the UN working with the Red Cross. We do everything that we can to set up these humanitarian corridors so that not only can vulnerable children and families get out, but also so that we can get in with these supplies. But the reality is, as we've seen over the last 3 months, is that it's all well and good to say, oh, well, there's a humanitarian corridor that's been agreed, and, you know, from this time to this time, the fighting will stop. But many families don't believe that, or they have no way of knowing that. In Mariupol, there was just zero communication. Families who were stuck there, children who were stuck there, had no way of knowing what was going on in the outside world. And so ultimately, the most important thing is that there is a peace agreement, that there is an end to the fighting. But worryingly, you know, it's been 3 months in Ukraine, and we've seen the absolute devastation it's caused for children and families. In Yemen, it's been 7 years. In Syria, it's been 11 years. And as the conflicts continue, as the fighting reverberates, the impact on children only increases.
Joe, what do the children in Ukraine need? What does UNICEF need?
You know, it's almost overwhelming in terms of our work. We try and make sure that we're touching every aspect of a child's life from being born all the way through to school. You know, we've been delivering desperately needed surgical supplies to hospitals across the country. We've been delivering, as you said, education supplies, something as simple as toys, but also clean water. In the east of the country, it's important to remember that this isn't just 3 months of war. It's been 8 long years that they've been dealing with this. So the needs are huge, and it's not just within the country. We know that millions have been displaced and are now refugees. Many, if not most, of the families that I speak to, they want to go back home. They want to be able to rebuild their lives in Ukraine. Right. But until that happens, we need international solidarity, international cooperation. Funding is absolutely critical. It always is.
All right, Joe, I'm going to end here on my laptop. People always ask when we do these shows, what can we do to help? At the top of Twitter at UNICEF, you say, as war rages in Ukraine, UNICEF is on the ground reaching children with water, health and education services. Here's how you can help, OK? And then we continue with our reporting on the Russia-Ukraine war. You can find that at aljazeera.com. Assad, do take care, stay safe. Thank you for bringing the story from the eastern side of Ukraine. We will continue to follow your reporting. That's our show for today. Thanks for watching. I'll see you next time.